Now, let's back up and just kind of revisit Stein and think about Mark's gospel in particular. Mark's gospel starts with the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And then you never hear the word Son of God mentioned again until Peter says it. Well, you got a few demons saying it. Then Peter says it in John 8. What is going on in Mark 8? What is going on in the gospel of Mark? Essentially, Mark is telling the story, hey, look what Jesus did. He is having control over nature. He is having control over disease. He's healing dead people. He's bringing them back to life. He has control over life and death. He teaches with authority. Remember, we got divine titles, we got divine words, we got divine actions from Jesus. He's doing stuff. And so what's the conclusion? It's the conclusion that Peter reaches at Caesarea Philippi. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Bang. Exactly. Flash moment. This is the idea. This is what's going on. What Bauckham is contending is these disciples who were strict monotheists, good Second Temple Jews, are encountering Jesus. And they're seeing him do stuff, and the idea is kind of being forced on them. They're coming to the conclusion, he's God. They don't arrive at this lightly. In fact, they resist it because it seems so incredible. They can't quite bring themselves to believe it, and yet they don't have any option. Based on what Jesus is doing and saying and what they're seeing with their own eyes, they can only reach one conclusion. Wow. Here is this being. He's not doing just creaturely thing. He's doing creator things. He must be in the God spot. That's the whole point. And so what Bauckham is arguing is instead of having a gradual progression of coming to the conclusion, he must be God, the very first disciples, the early church, watched Jesus in action, saw what was going on, and concluded, he's God. They knew because of what he was doing, that he had to belong to the divine identity. Did they have it all worked out? No, because they're not asking the what question. It's not even relevant to them. But they're seeing who he is, and they come to the conclusion he's God. And the reason this is important is because it's not as if the church got together and said, well, you know, if Jesus is really God, it'd really help our cause. Let's bump him up a little bit. It's the opposite. Jesus shows himself to be God, and the church starts confessing it from the very beginning. So what Bauckham contends is this. Instead of the church gradually arriving at the idea that Jesus is God, the idea is there from the very beginning, from Easter itself, from Pentecost. Right there, they knew everything. So instead of having a progressive development of our high divinity, it's there from the very beginning. And that's what he means by high Christology, that Jesus is fully God in every sense of the term. Where does that come from? It comes from what Jesus did in the economy of salvation. It comes from a from below. So we just watch Jesus and we come to the conclusion he's God. Because we only have two categories available to us. Semi-divine, that's not even a possibility. What do you mean semi-divine? He's more than a creature, and they knew it. All right?
Yeah. Why did Judaism go so wrong from that point forward then? If this was their philosophy and theory. The 12, being all Jews, seem to go in this direction. I know it's a deep question, but...
Well, once you reject Christ and you reject God's full revelation, you're kind of left behind. And once you make the move to say, no, he's not the Messiah, well, then you're going to resist it at every turn and fight against it, which is exactly what happens. And so, in a sense, Christ is the dividing moment. And Jesus always is. This is continually right down the present day. You start thinking about evangelism or missions, it's all about Jesus. He's the dividing thing. Where do you come down on Jesus? And once the Jewish faith decided, Jesus, nope, he's not our Messiah, then they're done. They've drawn their conclusion, and then everything else just kind of is expected. They just kind of flip out trying to make everything work, and because he's the dividing moment. So that's your answer. It's Jesus.
Yeah, there might be more to it, but wasn't the main reason why because he didn't establish an earthly kingdom?
They have expectations for what Messiah should do and would be doing, and Jesus didn't meet those expectations, so they dismissed it. But clearly some of the Jews came around, the 12, Paul, and quite a few others. So they would be able to say, hey, he is the fulfillment. We had our ideas wrong. But yeah, that was part of the problem is they had too many expectations built up, and a lot of the Second Temple Judaism didn't help because they were fomenting these ideas and pushing them forward. All right.
I guess this is something that I've wondered about and talked with people about. We're drawing this very distinct dichotomy between Greek thought and Hebrew thought. Given the time in which the Greek thought was progressed in the society in which they lived, would that Greek thought not have rubbed off on some of those early Jews?
There certainly were Hellenistic influences all over, and that can't be denied. But the Jews are pretty resistant. And in fact, the Palestinian Jews had no use for their Hellenistic counterparts living in Egypt, for example. They were sellouts, and they didn't have any interest in this. And so there were certainly these Hellenistic Jews. You've got Philo and Philo kind of coming into that category. We've got the kind of the interplay between Jewish thought and Hellenistic thought, and that's there. But the really good adherent conservative Jews would have resisted that tooth and nail, fought against it. There's no circumcision. You don't go to the bath. I mean, we get circumcised. We don't go to the public baths. We don't do stuff. And they were fighting it like crazy all through this time period. So in spite of the pervasiveness of Hellenistic thinking all over the world, they were rather resistant and held it off. Now, we're generalizing here with this, you know, Jewish thinking, Hellenistic thinking. It's overgeneralizations. But there is a clear distinction in how they would approach things and how they thought about things. All right, and they were able to insulate themselves much more effectively than we might realize. And we look around at, you know, your high Orthodox Jews today. Are they still pretty insulated? You know, they're managing to preserve themselves, and so it's kind of comparable in some way.
Yeah, I just think we don't often think about what philosophies are driving us.
Well, yeah, we should. I mean, I think about it all the time.
Maybe I hadn't until early or in my advanced education.
Fair enough. All right, page 18, he recaps the whole argument so far, so if you haven't gotten it, read there. And now what he's going to do, now he's going to take all of these ideas and move to his Christology. And basically, it's kind of elaborating what I just laid out for you. His central point, then, is on page 19, first full paragraph, I shall be arguing what will seem to anyone familiar with the study of New Testament Christology, a surprising thesis, that the highest possible Christology, the inclusion of Jesus in the unique divine identity, was central to the faith of the early church even before any of the New T writings were written, since it occurs in all of them. See, that's the point. It's not like they decided to start calling Jesus God. It was there before even one of the documents is written. It's written, is there basically with Easter, it's there with Pentecost, right off the bat. So there's no evolutionary view. We don't have this happening. And he makes his case on page 20 that even if you somehow believe that, well, for a while the church kind of put him in the semi-divine category, somewhere, sometime, he's got to make the quantum leap from there to godness. And that's a huge jump. And as he puts it on page 20, the decisive step of including Jesus in the unique identity of God was not a step that could be facilitated by prior less radical steps. It was a step which, whenever it was taken, had to be taken simply for its own sake and de novo. Just boom, out of the blue, there it is. And what would precipitate this? Not Council of Nicaea, Jesus himself. That's the argument Malcolm's going to make, and I think that's the right argument. All right, now he starts making his case for what's actually going on then in the early New T writers. And what he's going to say is, if we start looking at what's actually going on in the New Testament writers, we see them deliberately and intentionally putting Jesus in the God spot. And this is what's kind of cool here. You might say, this is getting to be a really tedious exegesis. Granted, I'm a systematician. I'm sympathetic to that idea. But his point is that these New T writers knew what they were doing, and they were putting Jesus here intentionally, very deliberately. So let's see the case he makes then. First point he's going to get into is that we have the exalted Jesus participates in God's unique sovereignty over all things. This is the point he's going to make, and now he's going to make his case. So we start with Psalm 110, most quoted section of the Old Testament in the New Testament. Did that surprise you? You know, a lot of us assume it must be something from Isaiah. Isaiah, he's got to be the most quoted. Nope. Psalm 110, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. And what's so great about this verse is because Jesus himself uses it during Passion Week, when he's having his day of confrontation on Tuesday with the Pharisees, and they're challenging him, and he finally kind of brings up one of his own little challenges. How is it that David says of the Messiah that he is his Lord? How can that be? And Jesus just leaves it. Rather poignant question. And the answer, of course, would be, well, maybe there's something more to this Messiah than we thought. And that's the whole point. Like, ding, 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 maybe he's God. And so Jesus himself uses this. All right. Bottom then of page 22. Second Temple Jewish literature is not interested in saying things about Jesus, things participating, that he participates in divine identity, sovereign over all things. In other words, the idea of taking Psalm 110 and applying it to Jesus is something that the Christians wanted to do, even though none of the early Jewish people were doing this, but the Christians wanted to, because this was exactly the point. Look, Jesus is in the God spot. That's the idea. All right, so then where do we see Jesus being sovereign over all things? Well, comes through very clearly in the New Testament again and again. And then we also have him being exalted above the angelic powers. And we have this coming through very clearly as well. We have this happening in Hebrews, where Jesus is above all the angels. And we also have it coming through in first part of John. And in Ephesians, we have this as well. God raised Jesus from the dead, seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places above all rule and authority and power and dominion, above every name that is named. And all things are under his feet. So we have this clear exaltation of Jesus way up to the top. And then we have point three on the bottom of 24. So Jesus has the participation in ruling all things. He's above angelic powers. And now he's given the divine name. And Bauckham contends that the tetragrammaton, Yahweh, okay, you are familiar with that. So that the tetragrammaton, Yahweh, God's divine name given at Sinai to Moses, I am, what I am, the rough translation, that this is God's unique name and that this name is being intentionally given to Jesus. And this is what happens in Philippians 2, and this is what also happens in Hebrews. This is his argument, that he is given the divine name, Yahweh, the name above all the names, Hebrews 1. And this is, in spite of what you hear in contemporary music, you know, the greatest name above all names, it's Jesus. No, it's Yahweh. That's the name that he's given. And he is participating in the Godhead himself. And then finally we have Jesus receiving worship, and this happens already in Jesus' ministry where you've got people who are healed worshiping Jesus, and you've got Thomas worshiping Jesus, and it's noteworthy to notice Jesus not say, Thomas, no, don't worship me. I'm just Jesus. I'm not the Father. But he receives and welcomes the worship, knowing full well that only God gets worship. So we have this coming through here very clearly. All right. So, now he makes the case that we have here, then, this growing case that all these things, Psalm 110 being used in the New Testament, is used to point to Jesus' divinity. We have Hebrews chapter 1, where Jesus is placed above all angelic powers. We have Philippians 2, where Jesus is given the divine name. And then we have Colossians and 1 Corinthians and Revelation, where Jesus is involved in creation. So not only do we have an eschatological, at the end, elevation of Jesus, but we have a protological elevation of Jesus, that all things were created through him, that nothing that is exists apart from him. So now, not only is Jesus' divinity stretching into the eschaton, but now it stretches back proleptically to the beginning into a protological kind of statement that he's even there at the beginning. Everything is created through him. And you might think that that's not a big deal, but it's a huge deal because now all the key points are happening. He is ruling all things, he is worshipped, and he is the creator as well. All things are created through him. So Jesus is fully participating in the divine identity. It's coming through in spades. And that's what we get on page 27 where he quotes 1 Corinthians 8. Hence, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that there is no idol in the world, and that there is no God except one. Indeed, even though there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as in fact there are many gods and many lords, but for us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and we through him. Wow. And it gets really cool, because Bauckham says, guess what Paul's doing there? He's taken the Shema and intentionally putting Jesus right smack in the middle of it. And he has a diagram here on the bottom of 27 to bear this out. For us, there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things, one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things. This he calls the Christian Shema, because you have our Lord of God is one, and we have this one God, but now the one God is present in Jesus and through Jesus. And for Paul to make this move intentionally is just extraordinary. And so then Bauckham kind of brings his argument to the kind of the pitch, right to the very pinnacle, and he says, all right, so now we have a choice. We've got all things being created through Jesus, Jesus participating. So now the question is, do we have two gods, dietheism, or what's the other option? A monotheism that includes Jesus in it. And what Bauckham says, that's where the early Christians came down. And now, back up to our second category of semi-divine intermediaries, we have ruled out category A, angels, as being relevant at all when it comes to the Jesus question. Have no value. Jesus is not an angel. He's not semi-divine. Nope. He's not kind of working his way up the scale on the way to Godhead. Then finally at Nicaea, he cashes in and gets to the God spot. No. Second category, though, category of the personifications of the divine being, is that helpful? And Bauckham says, yeah, big time. Because what Bauckham is going to argue is, first century Jew, let's take Paul for an example. So Paul is a good, strict monotheist. Being a good, strict monotheist, he also recognized the role of these personifications. So in other words, in even Paul's strict monotheism, was there a room for an intensification of God's presence in a personified way through wisdom or word? And the answer is yes. So where did Jesus get put in their thinking? Exactly. The word. The wisdom of God. So in other words, Jesus is kind of like, well, yeah, we already know about these personifications of God's presence among us. So now here we got Jesus of Nazareth, a personification of God present with us. But here's the new radical thing. Now it's incarnate. That's the kind of blow your mind that no one would have guessed. You know, the idea of kind of this metaphor of God's word or wisdom. Okay, we're cool with that. But to think that God would actually personify himself and join himself to human flesh, that's the thing that no one saw coming. That's the thing that kind of just made him stop and gasp and then kind of press forward. And the reason they press forward is not because they like the idea so much, but simply because Jesus gives them no alternative. He's in the God spot. Where does he belong? That's where we'll put him. That's where he belongs. He is the intensification, the very personification of God himself. There's only one God. We're not ditheists. We're not a duality. There's no ditheism here. There's only one God. But Jesus is clearly in God. Is God. That's the conclusion. This is pretty cool. And you see, and this is all built out of this theology or a Christology from below. It's all based on what Jesus actually did and said and the things that the people concluded about him based on what he was doing. And the conclusion is, he's God. Okay? Yep, Josh.
I'm pretty sure one of the arguments against the divinity of Christ as being something that was an early writing is when you look at a lot of the early church fathers before 325, a lot of the writings before then, and within the Bible, they would say there is no smoking gun that says Jesus is God.
Mm-hmm. Which is so stupid as not even be worth talking about. But we have to, because Jehovah's Witnesses bring it up all the time. But see, the argument is simply, come on, pay attention. You can't even flip a page in the Gospels without something there to scream out, hey, I'm God. And you know, the idea that Jesus never said he was God, you know, you get this from this rather facile argument from JWs all the time, which is absurd. Because he said he was to Caiaphas. He received the praise from Thomas. He makes the claim, you know, the Psalm 110 stuff. All these kinds of things. It's again and again and again and again. Now, the fact that it's not overt actually fits what we would expect, because how could he come out and say it like this, because no one knows what it quite means. They can't get it. And so, instead, you have the demonstration of the evidence, and then the conclusion is incontrovertible and has to be reached. That's the real point here. So to say, well, Jesus never said it, it's like, what do you want? He screamed it all the time. All right, good. So then finally, we get to page 30, and then he's talking about how we have these kind of ways of thinking about Jesus, whether we have a functional understanding of his divinity or an ontic understanding of his divinity. And the idea of a functional understanding is that Jesus is doing God stuff, and an ontic or an ontology is the idea of his being. So the functional is more the doing stuff. These are terms that 20th century theologians and Jesus thinkers used to try to say, all right. So what happened was the early church recognized that Jesus was doing some functions of the Godhead, but they knew he wasn't really God in his being. And again, Bauckham has no patience for this and just dismisses this. Bottom of 30. The dominance of the distinction between functional and ontic Christology has made it seem unproblematic to say that for early Christology, Jesus exercises the functions of divine lordship without being regarded as ontically divine. In fact, such a distinction is highly problematic from the point of view of early Jewish monotheism. For this understanding of the unique divine identity, the unique sovereignty of God was not a mere function which God could delegate to someone else. It was one of the key identifying characteristics of the unique divine identity which distinguished the one God from all other reality. God did not give out the job of ruling to other people. That's his role. And so there's not a distinction here. The unique divine sovereignty is a matter of who God is. Jesus' participation in the unique divine sovereignty is therefore also not just a matter of what Jesus does, but of who Jesus is in relation to God. And he wraps this all up in the bottom of 31, 12 lines up. Once the category of divine identity replaces those of function and nature as the primary and comprehensive category for understanding both Jewish monotheism and early Christology, we can see that the new T's lack of concern with the divine nature of Christ is by no means an indication of a merely functional Christology. They just weren't asking the question. It wasn't interesting to them. They didn't care. They were just confessing what they saw about who Jesus was. All right, this is the first part of Balcom's argument. Any holes, anything you're not clear on, you're tracking with all this. Now, are you seeing the magic? Why does this matter? Why is this a big deal? Do you get that? Why is this a huge deal?
Jesus' divinity isn't something that was invented.
All right. This goes to the core of our faith, guys. We're Christian. Everything hangs on the question of Jesus. Everything. If Jesus is not fully God, then we're a bunch of idiots. Because then we've got nothing more than a philosophy that tells you to be nice. We may as well be Muslim or Buddhist or Hindu. Who cares? But if Jesus is who he says he is, if he's fully God, everything changes. And that gets back to Bill's question earlier about the whole, what went wrong with Judaism? They got the Jesus question wrong. And how you answer the Jesus question is crucial. And what we're making the case for is that this conception, this confession of Jesus as fully God is not foisted on him by the church. It's not come up with later. It is clear from the very beginning. It's right there. This is a crucial, huge argument. All right? And that's why it does matter for systematics, because we're going to hang everything on the identity of Jesus. Everything. You lose that, you lose it all. It's gone. This is what Paul Meyer explores with his book, Skeleton in God's Closet. You know, what if they really dug up Jesus' bones? Would that change anything? And you've got, and the best part of the book is where you've got a bunch of liberal theologians saying, oh, it doesn't change anything because the concepts are all still the same. But anybody who thinks realizes, no, we're done. That's it. It's the end. Because it is. Everything hangs on his claim. All right. Everything cool? Now, we shift gears, and you, since you read more than you were supposed to, we can get into this next part. This is the next section starting on page 32. Now, Balcom kind of changes all the direction. Because so far, what he's been doing is he's been thinking about, okay, we've got the God category, and we've got creature category. Where does Jesus belong? In the God category. Why? Well, because he's creating, he's ruling, he's worship. He gets all the criteria. He's in the God spot. All good. Now, he's going to reverse everything and say, all right, if Jesus is in the God spot and his identity is one with the Godhead, then what does Jesus tell us about God? And so instead of kind of starting with God tells us that, you know, we know Jesus is in the God spot, well then if that's the case, what do we learn about God from Jesus? And that's where he's going in the second section here. And that's what he's going to start exploring. This is where things get really, really cool. All right, so away we go here. Summarizes, again, top of 32. If you've been losing the argument, read that and you'll get it, and you're back on track again. And this whole discussion is what he calls Christological monotheism. And I have been remiss by not putting this up here sooner. I should have done that a long time ago. Because this is the term that he uses for this whole thesis that he's developing. Christological monotheism. In other words, did the Jews have to compromise their monotheism to confess Jesus as God? No. This is the big point. They didn't have to compromise. They didn't have to cheat. They didn't have to cross their fingers. They were able to be fully monotheistic and be fully Christological. Jesus is God. That's Balcom's thesis. And that's why he calls it Christological monotheism. All right. Now, what does this Christological monotheism teach us about God himself? And that's where he's going next. All right. So you're cranking along in your reading. You get to page 33, and you're reading at the bottom of the page, and he says, no part of the Old Testament was more important to them, these early Christians, than the chapters we know as Deutero-Isaiah. And what happens to all you guys and all your sensitivities? You all have your flags going up, yellow flag, red flag, and thinking, hire a critic, and you're ready to go out and fillet Balcom, right? Some of you, I'm sure, reacted this way. Now, what does Balcom mean when he talks about Deutero-Isaiah? He explained himself the very next page. It's just the section of Isaiah from 40 to 55. And is there a marked difference between this part of Isaiah and the part that went before? Yes, there is. Even a conservative believer like us would have to admit this. All right. Higher critics used Deutero-Isaiah to say, well, we have a second Isaiah, and it was, you know, put together later. But we might say, hey, Isaiah can write the whole thing. Maybe he just changes style, or maybe some time elapses. It doesn't have to question anything. And even to use the term Deutero-Isaiah, it's more simply a convenient, this is the label, this part of Isaiah that we're talking about. Now, maybe we might not like the term Deutero-Isaiah because it has too many higher critical connotations, but Balcom is not a higher critic for using the term. Okay? Just want to make it very clear where we come down on these kinds of things. And he even later talks about Treto-Isaiah, and now you're really ready to have it. But he's talking about, these are the distinctions we see clearly in these different things going on. Now, why is Deutero-Isaiah, why is Isaiah 40 to 55 so important for the early church? You have the whole suffering servant motif going on in here, and the early church looked back at Isaiah 40 to 55 and recognized in this prophecy everything that played out with Christ. And you guys have been there. You've already done the Isaiah 52 to 53, and you read that, and it's like it's a fifth gospel account. It's so precise. It's unbelievable. Well, it is believable because it's prophecy and it's the Holy Spirit. But it's like, man, how can you deny this? It's incredible. And it is. And so this is why they're so big on this thing. So we go down to page 35, top of the page. Well, it's starting at the bottom of the page. It looks to the day when the God of Israel will demonstrate himself to be the one and only God in the sight of all the nations, revealing his glory and his salvation in the deliverance of his people, so that all the ends of the earth will acknowledge him as God and turn to him for salvation. It is in his great act of eschatological salvation, the new Exodus, that the one and only God will demonstrate his unique deity universally. Yeah, exactly. The new Exodus. Well, when is the new Exodus? It's going to be the whole Christ event. See, remember when we were doing the Stein stuff, and I said the whole Passover meal is just huge at the Last Supper. And all the connections are there. The hyssop, the blood, the lamb, the covenant, the new covenant. All these things are there. And then we have this awesome thing in the Gospel of Luke, where Luke says that at the Mount Transfiguration, Moses and Elijah appeared. And what were they discussing with Jesus? They were discussing his ex-hadas, his traveling down to Jerusalem. And the word in Greek is Exodus. Man, this is so cool. So Jesus is intentionally bringing about this new Exodus, this new Passover, and that's what's going on with Isaiah, because Isaiah 40-55 is describing this inauguration of this new covenant, this new thing that's going to happen. And that's why the New Testament writers are all over it, because of all the connections. All right, into that same paragraph, it was in the context, this context of the necessary link between the uniqueness of God and his eschatological acts for the salvation of Israel and the world that the early Christians read of the enigmatic figure of the servant of the Lord, who witnesses to God's unique deity and who in chapters 52 to 53 both suffers humiliation and death and also is exalted and lifted up. And this is the foreshadowing of everything that Balcom's going to do here. Now his thesis. What I hope to show is that in the early Christian reading of Deutero-Isaiah, the witness, the humiliation, the death, and the exaltation of the servant of the Lord is the way in which God reveals his glory and demonstrates his deity to the world. The witness, the humiliation, and the exaltation of the servant are the eschatological salvation event, the new Exodus, by which the unique deity of God is now identified, such that the ends of the earth acknowledge that God is God and turn to him for salvation when they see the exaltation of his servants. Then now he's going to give us three key passages in Isaiah, in this part of Isaiah, 40 to 55, which bring this out. Isaiah 52, 13, behold, my servant shall prosper, he shall be exalted and lifted up, and shall be very high. Key terms, exalted and lifted up. Go to Isaiah 6:1. Now, this is out of that corpus, but Isaiah 6:1 is normative because this is where you have the vision where Isaiah gets his mandate. I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, exalted and lofty, and his train filled the temple. And then Isaiah 57, for thus says the exalted and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place, and also with those who are crushed and lowly in spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly, to revive the heart of the crushed. So, very clearly here, we have this idea of this strong connection between high, lofty, and lifted up, high and lifted up. And then he talks about this Jewish hermeneutic of when you have two words coming together in a consistent way, you need to pay attention to what's going on here, and that's exactly what he's doing. So then he wraps things up then, the bottom of 36, connecting it to Psalm 110. The servant, in both his humiliation and his exaltation, is therefore not merely a human figure distinguished from God, but in both his humiliation and his exaltation, belongs to the identity of the unique God. This God is not only the high and lofty one who reigns from his throne in the high and holy place, he also abases himself to the condition of the crushed and the lowly. And when the nations acknowledge his unique deity and turn to him for salvation, it is the servant, humiliated and now exalted to sovereignty on the divine throne, whom they acknowledge. So what he's going to say then is that what we actually see playing out in the New Testament is that Christ, in his humiliation, is showing us the identity of God. And it's not as if the humiliation somehow is opposed to the divinity of God. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The humiliation displays the full divinity of God. That's the contention he's going to make. So in other words, we have shifted the arrows. Instead of thinking about Jesus in his godness, now we're thinking about what God is because of who Jesus is and what we learn about God. And that's where he's going to go with the rest of this stuff. All right, questions or comments here? Any clarification needed? All right, so you're set for next time. Everything should be in place so you can crank forward and have a delightful reading experience for Friday. So do that. Come prepared, and we will wrap up Balcom just in time for the Christmas break, and you can go home and really celebrate the Incarnation with some better knowledge this year. Blessings.